Welcome back to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell, and this is Season 3. We are glad so many of you have stuck with us and helped send more people our way. This season, we bring back some familiar voices, as well as several new ones. Every interview, I learn something new, and I hope you do too. And if you're joining us for the first time, welcome. Here's a bit more information on what this podcast is all about.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices.
Well, hey everyone, I am, as usual, very excited about my guest today. I have the pleasure of talking with and discussing a really interesting topic with Dr. John Huckabee. So welcome, Dr. Huckabee.
Thanks, Gail. I really appreciate this opportunity.
We're going to talk about the art of wildlife rehabilitation, and we're going to get really a deep dive into this. But before we do, do you think you could get everybody just a little synopsis of your origin story in wildlife rehab?
My origin story is really not typical. A lot of that was because I was raised by nomadic Texans, although I was the only one in the immediate family not born in Texas. And okay. I was a different child and didn't really fit the mold that was indoctrinated by my family, culture, and religion of origin. Okay. I wasn't exactly the black sheep of my family, more like a sheep of many colors.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yeah. One of my brothers convinced me that I was an alien when I was very young. So that is a probably unnecessary information, but can explain an awful lot about me.
Okay. Did your brother happen to mention what planet he thought you were from?
No, he didn't. We were in Roswell, New Mexico at the time. So that may have entered into the picture.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Yeah. I probably convinced you, at least for a little while.
Yeah, it wasn't hard back then. But we were nomadic because of my dad's job as a seismologist and geophysicist in the oil industry. So we lived wherever he was busy looking for oil. So I grew up around the oil fields of New Mexico and West Texas, and then in Alberta, also known as the Texas of Canada, followed by Louisiana. So from K through grade 12, skipping grade 11, I averaged 1.3 years per school. So that would be 9 schools in 2 countries, or 3 countries if you can count Texas as its own, 3 different states, 1 province, 6 towns or cities, basically 6 different communities, and graduated high school at the age of 16. It seemed that I was always the new weird kid who not only talked funny, but also struggled to put 2 words together when picked out of the crowd or put in the spotlight. I was targeted for being different and bullied until I figured out appropriate predator avoidance skills. I excelled academically. I learned the art of camouflage, blending in, and not attracting attention to myself. I became very adaptable, which helped me a great deal in the wildlife rehabilitation field. I was interested in animals and wildlife biology, which no one in my family could ever quite figure out. My exposure as a teenager to wildlife in the Rocky Mountains is what cemented my interest in wildlife. That was in the late 60s and early 70s, and I wanted to make a difference and do something to benefit animals and especially wildlife. I was also drawn to animal welfare issues in general. As an undergraduate, I majored in zoology and was determined I was going to help wildlife. I was determined to become a veterinarian. I was very naive.
I don't mean to laugh, but I remember my journey was different, but I wanted to be a vet as well. And I didn't get into vet school and actually was pretty happy about that. Sorry. I mean, I love medicine and I love being veterinary adjacent, I guess, rehab, but I think that was, I'm glad that I didn't get accepted.
No, I can understand that. And back at back in the day, being a wildlife rehabilitation veterinarian just wasn't a thing.
Right.
So I was determined that I was going to go in that direction and did everything that I could. And as a gay kid growing up in an unfriendly and very dangerous culture for me, and I had no emotional safety at home, I felt trapped. I was caged by my circumstances. I lived in constant fear. So in my own way, I can relate with and have profound empathy for wild animals in cages.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Texas A&M was the third university I attended, and it's where I received both of my Bachelor of Science degrees, zoology and in veterinary science, and my DVM. It took a lot of dedication, single-minded determination, and perseverance. I graduated from vet school 38 years ago and have been involved with wildlife rehabilitation continuously since then. In the vet hospital where I first practiced, 2 of the vet techs were wildlife rehabilitators, and I credit them with providing much training and mentoring me in the wildlife rehabilitation field, as well as in some of the art of veterinary practice. Gaining so much experience with them and the wildlife rehab community in the region around Houston, all that was foundational for my development in understanding appropriate and strong ethical principles of wildlife rehabilitation. I was also the spearhead for the first wildlife rehabilitation center in the Houston area in the 90s, before moving to the Seattle area and the Paws Wildlife Center in 1998. Well, I'm no longer young or naive, and I lived my dream job. So now I'm retired and living my best life on the other side. Yes, life does continue after rehab.
But you always notice you can't unsee things still.
Oh, sure. No. You can't unsee. You can't really unexperience them either.
Exactly. Exactly. You just can't. You can't. But wow. And you've your lived experience in physically many different places, I think probably helped inform a lot. But I also want to just give a shout out to vet techs and vet techs that help in wildlife rehabilitation. And there's a lot of vet techs that have permits and either work for centers or are independent rehabilitators. So just a big shout out to them.
Then
certainly all the rest of us that don't have that training either, but we're certainly giving it a go. But the vet techs are amazing.
Right. Oh, they are. They are. And wildlife rehabilitators in general are amazing with their knowledge and their capabilities and their understanding of wildlife on many levels. So a shout out to all the wildlife rehabilitators as well as the vet techs, and the combination vet tech wildlife rehabilitator, even better.
I know. So that was nice to hear as part of your story. I do want to ask, because you've been in the field for a long time and you've seen a lot of changes and you really witnessed the kind of the growth of professionally recognized, maybe that's the phrase, because most of us have strived all along to be very professional in our own work, but recognized from the outside, maybe. There's still some struggles there. But have you seen, like, within wildlife rehabilitation, changes for the better? I mean, everything changes over time. But are there certain things that, like, oh, that's so much better than it was 20 years ago? Anything like that? Or maybe that just all blends together after a while, right? I can say this to Dr. John because we've known each other for a long time, and he's been in the field for 38 years. I've been in the field for a little over 30, but I'm not going to claim 38.
Right. Okay. I'm well into my fourth decade at this point. So, and yes, by far, most of the changes that that I've seen are for the better. I'll list a few. There's so many more opportunities for vets and vet students to get training specific to wildlife and the concept of wildlife rehabilitation. Again, back when I started pursuing it, it really wasn't a thing on the veterinary side to consider it a career choice.
Right. Did people look at you funny anyway? Like wildlife?
Wow. Well, I'm used to people looking at me funny from the time my memory kicked in. So, yeah, but I've gotten very used to that. And I generally, especially now, I don't worry about people thinking I'm strange because, well, they're right.
They're right. And that's okay. I'm in that same camp. You were... Right. Didn't obviously have the same experiences growing up, but I was definitely, and I would call myself the black sheep of the family. The family did not, they understood veterinary medicine and going into, like, because I wanted to work with horses is what I wanted to do.
Right.
But wildlife, what? Right. Why would you die? What?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was just animals in general for me, again, with my dad in the oil industry, and I've got three older brothers, and all of them were in the oil industry at points in their career, and most of their careers. The oldest actually was in nuclear energy for quite a long time. So for me to be interested in animals and the environmental things, coming from an energy associated family and engineering. And that was the course that my father was determined that I was going to pursue.
Wow.
And that was the area that, well, we never really were able to communicate well with each other. So here I am, stranger than my family and stranger than most other people. But that's a...
You found a home in wildlife rehabilitation.
Yes, and the, I love my wildlife rehabilitation family because so many have been misunderstood much of their life as well.
Yep.
So it's the understanding of wildlife rehabilitation, wildlife rehabilitators, that has grown greatly over the course of my career. Mm-hmm. And the understanding in the veterinary field that treatment of wildlife for release is very different than that for domestic animals, exotic pets, and for captive wildlife in zoos. Mm-hmm. So veterinarians and wildlife rehabilitators make for a very strong team to provide the best care practices and successful rehabilitation for wildlife patients, and work best together when they stay in their lanes of expertise. As a rule, wildlife rehabilitators are not veterinarians, although all too often find themselves doing veterinary procedures by default.
Right.
Veterinarians are generally not wildlife rehabilitators and will often treat injured wildlife like they do exotic pets. Vets don't always make the best rehabilitators, whereas some are outstanding. And we'll explore that relationship a little more later in this conversation, I believe.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that's a great explanation a little bit. And if you've got more, I'll take it.
Oh, I've got more.
Okay. Let's go.
I'm very pleased to have seen the advancement, as you mentioned earlier, the advancement of the field of wildlife rehabilitation into a more scientific and evidence-based profession, with the accompanying increase in professionalism of wildlife rehabilitators. And these, I think, were tremendous changes for the better. Wildlife rehabilitation is now much more respected by wildlife agencies, biologists, and academics as a viable profession and not so much of a hobby. Now, wildlife rehabilitators are more often seen as colleagues, and the value of their work is being recognized more and more. The COVID pandemic over the last 3 years has really spotlighted the One Health concept and the place wildlife rehabilitators hold at the intersection between the health of humans and domestic animals and the environment and wildlife species. Wildlife rehabilitators are on the front line of seeing wildlife come to them and are more able to detect abnormalities in those individuals. And there's much greater recognition of the importance of their role in the surveillance, recognition, and identification of emerging disease threats like infectious zoonotic diseases, environmental toxins, pesticides, and on and on and on. There are now also is a wonderful change for the better. There are now more large wildlife rehabilitation centers and consequently more opportunities to actually be paid for being a wildlife rehabilitator or a wildlife rehabilitation veterinarian. There's still a long way to go in this regard, although there's been a great increase in the number of job opportunities from, well, basically zero from 40 years ago to where we are today. In the 2022 annual report of the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association, 0.3% of member vets, so that's fewer than 300 vets, identified as being wildlife or captive wildlife veterinarians.
Wow.
The number of wildlife rehabilitation veterinarians is far fewer than that.
Right.
But it is growing. To switch gears just a little bit, not totally, back in the day, there was a phrase that was very common in the veterinary profession and was specifically taught in vet schools at the time. That phrase was that no animal should die without the benefit of steroids. Dexamethasone was cheap, easy to come by, and masked a lot of signs, so animals would feel much better for a while before they died. Before they got better.
Or before they got better, yeah.
Vets and rehabilitators used it indiscriminately without recognizing the numerous negative effects, including immunosuppression, delayed wound healing, and many others. Eventually, judicious use of corticosteroids for specific therapeutic purposes replaced the practice of administering dexamethasone just because. Baitril, next on board. Baitril, or enrofloxacin, was new about the time I graduated and the first of a new class of antibiotics to be approved for veterinary use. It was a miracle drug and very effective for specific purposes and specific infections. It was very expensive, though easy to come by, and the Baitril because syndrome was initiated in the rehab community, resulting in it being used indiscriminately for animals coming in for rehabilitation. Antimicrobial resistance was already being recognized in many of the older antibiotics, although it did not come onto the radar early on for invincible drugs like Baitril until a couple of decades after its introduction. About 20 years ago, we started seeing Baitril-resistant bacteria showing up in cultures taken from animals presented from the wild, indicating how widespread antimicrobial resistance was reaching in the environment and the realization how the miracle drugs like Baytril were losing effectiveness, exacerbated by indiscriminate use. Ivermectin was another miracle drug introduced in the mid-80s for treating many types of parasites. It does not work for COVID treatment, by the way, nor does hydroxychloroquine. But I digress. Ivermectin also is used indiscriminately by many vets and rehabilitators. The parasites it was so good at controlling have also now developed resistance to this drug, effectively reducing the tools we have for controlling those infections or preventing their spread. Indiscriminate use is declining, I think, with ivermectin, although it is still used liberally and without diagnosing infection with likely susceptible parasites. Meloxicam is currently one of the drugs frequently used somewhat indiscriminately in wildlife rehabilitation. It is not subject to antimicrobial resistance, yet the potential negative effects are often not being understood, recognized, or sometimes considered before it is used. In the majority of wildlife patients, it is given in the hope that it will reduce pain and therefore stress in the animal at hand. In my mind, this is very well intentioned, although it might be misguided. When pain meds are deemed necessary, use them judiciously in well-hydrated patients, along with supplemental fluids to support the kidneys and other physiologic processes for optimal healing. Pain management is far more than giving medications, and many management practices can be used to mitigate pain and stress in captivity. Interrupting the cycle of pain, then staying ahead of pain are key to effective pain management. Some of the things that can be done for that. Appropriate medication might be necessary to interrupt the pain cycle. Then captive management procedures can help to stay ahead of the pain. Work with your vet for evaluation, diagnostics, and then treatment plan. It's important to reduce the stress and handling of patients throughout the rehab process. Rehydrate them, keep them warm, put them in a quiet space away from predators and where they have a secure place to hide. Provide them a secure place to hide. Strict cage confinement might be necessary. Appropriate substrates and furniture for the species and the stage of healing are important even from the very early stages of healing. Covering and dressing their wounds, as indicated, and with appropriate materials can also greatly reduce the amount of pain that is perceived by the animals. And effectively immobilizing fractures will reduce a great amount of pain in animals with fractures. The potential for wildlife patients to be injured with capture and restraint to physically administer a scheduled treatment is a concern. Please don't cause more stress and trauma to the patient to give them a medication just in the hope that it might help. The potential for nephrotoxicity with the NSAIDs, including meloxicam, is not always being recognized. We're dealing with so very many different species for which the pharmacology of medications has not been figured out. In wildlife rehab, we see a lot of animals that die in care. We do not often know why, nor do we have the resources to do extensive necropsy and testing workups to find out. The cautionary tale involves the old world vultures. The gyps vultures are exquisitely sensitive to the nephrotoxicity of the NSAID drug, diclofenac. They were pushed to the brink of extinction from kidney failure on the Indian subcontinent 15 to 20 years ago, because these birds were consuming the diclofenac residues in the carcasses of calves that had been treated with the drug for its potent anti-inflammatory effects. The bottom line of all of this, please be careful and judicious using any medications. Be able to knowledgeably justify their use and avoid the just because syndrome.
Yeah, the just because syndrome, I love it. Boy, a lot of the things, it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? We have the development of these wonderful medications that all of a sudden we can reach for to help with pain or those kinds of things. And then the other side of that is not using them with good judgment. Or I don't want to say that, but not using them thinking about the future, right? About resistance and all those kinds of things. I mean, it is the One Health thing, right? It's not just right. about not being able to use these medications in these animals. It's about it's getting in the food chain and coming right on up to humans, right? So, and livestock and humans. And if these bacteria are resistant, in particular, you know, the antibiotics, resistant, well, now we have less tools in our toolbox instead of more.
So. Right. And there's so many different considerations that have to be made. For many medications, there are federal regulations that prohibit the use of those medications in food animals. And as wildlife rehabilitators, we have to recognize many of the species we work with are hunted. And so if they are treated with medications that similar species have withdrawal periods before they can be released in order to prevent that medication getting in the human food chain and possibly causing problems there, those medications, by extrapolation, should not be used in wildlife species that can be hunted to prevent those medications in the event they were hunted and consumed by humans that they would be exposed to. So there are a lot of considerations with many of the drugs that are used.
And just a note, most of the veterinarians out there should know that, but may the wildlife rehabilitators out there may not know, is that there is a website where you can check what drugs, at least currently, can be used, when they can't be used, can be used, and then the withdrawal time, or can't be used at all because of the hunted species. And we'll put a link in the show notes. And of course, I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but it's FARAD. FARAD, and it stands for food something something.
Yeah, food animal residues.
Thank you.
The first part of that, and the regulations themselves are under the AMDUCA Act, AMDUCA.
So, along with a lot of the things that have changed for the better, whether it is more paid positions and that kind of thing, more. Therapeutics that we might be able to reach for. One of the things we haven't defined yet for, and is the title of this podcast episode, is what is the art of wildlife rehabilitation? Because both of us know it when we see it.
Right.
But how do we define it?
Yeah. Well, it is difficult to really define, because in a lot of ways it's intangible, just like art of any sort. But the art of wildlife rehabilitation brings together a lot of different things. And first, just an observation. Vets and rehabilitators have many similar traits. Primary among them is the need to help animals, mm-hmm. to fix them and to fix their problems. And there's a guiding star that I think is always useful and always very helpful to have in mind to guide the decision processes and the rehabilitation process as a whole. Always do what is best for the individual's welfare based on natural history and population considerations. So having a deep knowledge and understanding of species' natural history is a fundamental principle and is a fundamental part of becoming an artist of wildlife rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
A significant part of the art is simply the power of observation and recognizing things that are not typical for the species. Knowing when to back off and let natural healing take over, aka stop interfering by trying to fix something when the animal is able to heal better on its own, is a big part of the art of wildlife rehabilitation, and is knowing when to not do anything beyond supportive care, appropriate caging, and captive management to allow that animal to heal.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just about healing, too. I mean, I I've always used natural history. I have a degree in biology, so I've always been interested in the natural world and everything, and I just dive deep into any natural history of any animal that I might be either presented with that I don't know anything about, or even just when I'm out nature walks. I mean, that's what I do. So that one takes a little time to kind of get the groove to figure out what sources are really good for natural history and who you should go to, and now what websites are good ones to go to, right? But I did want to make a comment about observation, because a lot of people sometimes when they're first starting out it's hard for them to see certain things.
Right.
But the great thing about observation is you can improve your observation skills. All you have to do is practice. I mean, it's pretty amazing. You can just, you know, do it right now. Go out in your backyard and just sit down for a minute and look at a patch of grass and look at the ants that are walking around and just watch what they do. Just watch what they do. And then, and then the next time you come to that patch of grass looking at the ants, you're going to notice more. And then the next time you're going to notice more. And I'm picking on something like an insect like ants, because a lot of us don't take the time to watch them and how they interact with each other and how they interact with the environment and things like that. And so it's a really a species most of us don't know a whole lot about. So or a group of animals we don't know much about. So, but you can improve your observation skills. And we cannot, as wildlife vets, wildlife rehabilitators, if I'm training somebody new, I can't always tell you all the different challenges you might see and all the different wounds and all the different things. I can't. But what we can do is try to help you know what is normal, because what is normal is going to help you determine what is not normal. And then you can work with your mentors, you can work with your veterinarian to try to figure out, well, why? Why is this not normal?
Yeah, no, I really appreciate you talking about that. And it just brought something to mind with me as well, in that a strong curiosity.
Well, yeah, maintaining that curiosity, right?
So having and maintaining a strong sense of curiosity, I think, is a very important attribute in developing observation skills and understanding the natural histories of any species, whether it's ants, whether it's birds, whether it's birds eating ants, anting, which is different than eating them. But so just having that curiosity to learn, to observe, to pick up things that you're not going to understand by reading off of the internet.
Exactly.
I was going to say reading a book, but that's becoming a lost art.
But
reading a book, learning from others, there are things that are just very difficult to actually verbalize or to put into words that you'll notice when you're watching nature happen.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and the more you practice, the better you get. The other little tip I give people, especially about observation skills, and you don't have to be, a lot of people say, I can't do art, I can't draw, whatever, everybody can. Yeah. And one of my passions is art and drawing. And you can do what is called field sketching. And field sketching is the art of observation. It's not the making the beak look perfect if you're talking about a bird or the feathers or anything. That's not the point at all. It is about capturing a moment in time. And what you're really doing is capturing behavior. And it just increases your observation skills hundredfold.
Yes. Right.
So there you go. Another pro tip.
Right. Yeah. You know, so how long do you think it takes to become an artist of the of drawing or of painting?
I don't know. I think that obviously, just like with rehabilitation, the dedication and the time put in may help you get farther along. But I don't know if you're ever finished with that journey. right? It's a lifelong journey, and it should be a journey that is joyful and you're really interested and engaged with. And I think of that in wildlife rehabilitation too. I mean,
absolutely.
I don't care what walks through the door. I'm like, yes, I want to help it, right? I want to figure it out, but I am as enthused about, you know, this young rabbit that has come through, and I've seen hundreds of them, right?
Right.
I might be a little tired depending on the time of the season, but I'm still, you know, like really engaged and let's go and let's figure this out.
Right, right. And I like that you express it as being a joyful process, because there's certainly a lot of joy in wildlife rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. There's sometimes a lot of heartbreak as well. And with the developing powers of observation, it is difficult sometimes to recognize, and this might be a little indelicate, but it is difficult to recognize when we're working with nature's rejects and when pursuing wildlife rehabilitation measures are not warranted for that individual.
Right. Yeah, it's the young bird that's developing incorrectly, or there's something genetically wrong with it, you know, something congenital, and it gets kicked out because it's different. And we do get a portion of those. I'm not going to say all of the young birds that we get are like that, because that's certainly not the case. But certainly a portion of them are. And being able to recognize that is, I think, is a part of the art, right?
Yes. And sometimes it may take a long time before you figure out, this one is just not right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the, isn't this a vet term, ADR, ain't doing right?
Absolutely.
You don't know exactly what it is, but you know.
Right, right.
ADR.
Yeah. Yeah, but that can be a symptom of a lot of things that are fixable. Mm-hmm. But I would sometimes use the acronym KNR. So kid's not right.
Kid's not right. I like it.
Yeah, it's kind of like it. But there's something that appears to be unfixable,
right?
With this,
or they're just not. And it's with those observation skills and knowing the natural history and knowing what's normal. This ADR or KDR animal, maybe you can't. It's not obvious, right? There's not an obvious fracture or something like that. But you're like, you know, your little sixth sense, your little flags are going up in the back of your head, and you need to pay attention to those. You know, some people say, you've got sixth sense. And it's like, no, I think you're just noticing things and you're just now paying attention to those things that you're noticing.
Right. Yeah. Well, there is some intuition that goes into it at times too. So that's that as well is a part of the art, but it's very intangible with that.
It is very intangible, which is hard because, you know, how do you recognize the art of wildlife rehabilitation?
Right. Well, hopefully the people that are listening to the podcast are coming to realize that there's so much involved in the art that it is something that is a long-term process. It takes a commitment, and we'll be talking a little bit more about some of these things later. Mm-hmm. But it's just understanding that having a strong foundation in the basic principles of healing, medicine, biomechanics, physical therapy and conditioning, and so many other factors that are needed for restoring the function of the individual for survival in the wild. So using creative approaches in setting up enclosures and cages, approaching physical therapy, stress and pain management, using innovation and nuance customized to the individual, the circumstances are all a part of the art.
That was Dr. John Huckabee. Dr. Huckabee is a retired wildlife veterinarian and wildlife rehabilitator who joined me for an in-depth conversation on the art of wildlife rehabilitation. This was part one of two. In part two, we'll cover learning to separate what feels good to us from what is good for the animal. Dr. Huckabee draws on true stories from his clinical work to provoke thought about what is best and what is right in difficult circumstances. We discuss how to accept and learn from mistakes, and we also cover some basics of finding and working with the right mentor. I hope you enjoyed this first episode of Season 3. Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand in hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the partnership coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota, College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Klocke. Special thanks to our guest, Dr. John Huckabee, Partners for Wildlife, and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.